This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Peter Liam. We'll talk to Peter about champagne and more. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Peter Liam is an award-winning author, writer, wine critic, educator, and truly one of the world's great champagne experts. Peter is the author of Champagne, the essential guide to the wines, producers, and terroirs of the iconic region. Peter oversees champagneguide.net, an online comprehensive guide to the wines and producers of Champagne. He is the co-founder, co-creator of La Fête du Champagne, and is a prolific deep sea diver. Peter has brought himself closer to the region he loves, living in Champagne for over 15 years, and comes back to the U.S. every now and then. Peter, welcome back to the Grape Nation.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you.
I just want to mention that you last joined us on the podcast in 2017. When I think about the last time I spoke to you, it doesn't seem like over 4 years ago.
Yeah, that was
early in our podcast. So I thank you now for coming on. And I thank you then for sort of a fledgling podcast, putting some faith into it and coming on. So thank you. We're talking to Peter remotely via Zencastr. Peter, where are you right now?
Actually, I am here in New York at the moment.
Okay. All right. So I mentioned in the intro that you live in Champagne, and obviously you also come back to the U.S. Don't spend a ton of time, but tell us why you ultimately made Champagne your home. And for me, as a curiosity, why not Germany or Spain? And how do you split your time?
Yeah, well, so, you know, I've been in the wine trade since 1996. I guess just getting involved with Champagne, certainly Champagne was a very different place and it was a very different environment back in the 90s. And of course, I was introduced to Champagne like anybody else in the wine trade, through major names and trying to taste as much as I possibly could. In the late 90s and early 2000s, this was a period of tremendous change in Champagne. And so I began going to the region in 1997. That was my first trip there. And what struck me immediately was. That the things that I was seeing on the ground were completely different than things that I was reading in books or even in magazines. Nobody was talking about this stuff. And it had stuff to do with viticulture and terroir and, small producers that you never heard of and all this kind of thing that we take for granted now. But in 1997, this was completely, to somebody in an export market, this was completely new territory.
Right.
And so that became very interesting. And I kept going back to Champagne, every year, once or twice a year. And that's, even though I was working with the wines of the world and I had a deep interest in many areas, at the time, I was working a lot with Burgundy. I was very heavily involved with Riesling, in Germany and Austria and Alsace. But I think just this whole kind of story of Champagne, seeing how rapidly the region and the Appalachian was changing, that really made me want to spend more time there. And
so,
Yeah, it got to a point where, you know, going there once or twice a year just wasn't enough. And so by the end of 2006, I had, you know, made plans to really relocate, you know, to France, and I made my home in the Champagne region. And
any regrets not sooner?
Well, I mean, you know, it was, everything's a product of circumstance. You know,
right.
And certainly moving from one country to another is never an easy task. So it's all right.
All right. So let me, you mentioned a lot of areas and topics that I think we're going to get into, some in, you know, some depth. Let me frame our conversation by asking you this. You said you've been traveling to Champaign since 97, which is, you know, a substantial amount of time. And probably as long or more than anyone. Let's get into it a little. Can you articulate some of those changes you refer to, significant ones, and even the subtle ones, you know, that you've witnessed through the years? I mean, and a bigger question is, has Champaign re-examined itself, and is there a new paradigm there? Mm-hmm. So that's a big question, Peter.
Yeah.
But I trust in you.
Well, I mean, this is really the story of contemporary Champaign. You know, the short answer is absolutely yes. At the time, I think, you know, 25 years ago, Champaign, I mean, from all sides, from the producer side, from the consumer side, from the, you know, wine professional side, Champaign, the way that we treated Champaign was very different. You know, we haven't historically, well, when I say historically, that's like the last 50 years, right? We haven't always thought about Champaign as a wine. You know, Champaign has been, you know, more about branding, more about, you know, a product of celebration, you know, something you have on your birthday, and you know, all of this stuff like helps to sell Champaign, but it kind of detracts from its qualities as a wine. You know? And for me, you know, I always say that everything that's going on right now in Champaign is really symptomatic of a change in the way that we've viewed it. So it's about us actually treating Champaign as a real wine now. And so along with that come up all these other questions that we ask of any other wine, right? We talk about viticulture, we talk about vinification, we talk about terroir, we talk about all these other things. And that's just natural when you talk about a wine and a wine region and all of this. In the past, we didn't talk about that so much with Champaign. And so Champaign was really just about brand. It was like you would go to Champaign and, you know, you would talk about the Champaign process, and you know, it was thought that, or not thought, it was said you know, it was lees aging and then the Champaign process that really gave the wine its identity, which, you know, I think even back then winemakers didn't believe, but that's what they would tell us as consumers. And so it was really around, you know, around the mid-90s that the beginnings of the conversation really started to pick up steam, where you had these producers, you had these winemakers in Champaign really starting to question this paradigm, or the paradigm that we were in, right? And starting to, there was kind of a new generation who, you know, for one, they were drinking other wines of the world, which hasn't always been the case, you know, back even just a short time ago, you know, France was very, very provincial. And oftentimes, you know, the previous generation wouldn't be familiar with wine regions, even within their own country. And, but, you know, you had this new generation who were not only drinking wines and visiting other regions, but, you know, maybe had worked, had gone to school, you know, elsewhere, had, you know, worked, you know, internships, sometimes even abroad, you know, in the New World or whatever, or elsewhere in Europe. And so they were coming back and they were starting to ask questions about champagne in the same way that other people in the wine world were asking questions, right?
So that prompted.
Yeah, that prompted a sort of re-examination of what are we doing here in Champagne, and what does Champagne even mean, right? You know, you know, at first you had these pioneers. Everyone talks about Anselm Salos, of course, right? You know, I mean, clearly he's like this godfather of this whole like this whole thing. But and then you know you have you know other people like Francis Egli, you know who started quite early. But then, you know, in the mid '90s, you know, people that influenced me were, you know, people like Pascal Agrippard, Pierre Larmandier of Larmandier Bernier, Laurent Champ of Villemar, and so these conversations with them really made me think about champagne in a very different way. And then shortly after this, then you have like the beginning of the 2000s, where you have another generation coming in who. And here's where it really starts to pick up steam. You know, people like Jérôme Prévost, Vouet de Sorbet, you know, Cédric Bouchard, all of these guys started all around the same time, around like 2000, you know, and a little bit later, you know, like Raphael Baresh, you know, came on to, he joined his family was already making excellent wines, but, you know, rejoined the estate in 2004, you know, Alex Chartone in 2006. And so you have this, you know, this other generation coming in, which was very exciting. And then at this point, it sort of gained this critical mass where you really start to see the region changing. Yeah. And also, it's not just about production. It's about, it was about what was going on in export markets as well. You know, most notably in the United States, you had grower champagne being imported already, right? And Kermit Lynch already, you know, I was working with Paul Barra and
Terry Thies.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, other people were working with individual producers. Terry Thies was the first to really come out and say, here is a portfolio of champagnes that you've never heard of.
Right.
You know, and that was really powerful. That was game changing, and so you know, even though he wasn't the first, you know, to import grower champagne, I think, you know, he did the most to really get the conversation going here in the States,
right?
And that had an effect, you know, even back in Champagne, because, you know, the U.S. is a major champagne market. You know, it had an effect in other export markets, you know, where people are like, oh, you know, what's going on here? You know, maybe we need to pay attention to this too. But then I think, you know, that encouraged this kind of newer generation to start going in their own direction and you know,
so
seeing that there were markets interested in what they were doing.
It's fair to say, based on what you're saying, in the early 2000s, that was really the launch, I don't know, the beginning of the grower champagne market, because you refer to Salos, who was sort of older school but new thinking, and then other makers that, you know, were of a newer generation, and then a category of growers. Is that fair to assess it that way?
Yeah, I mean, broadly, I suppose. Back when I started in the wine trade, you know, in the mid-90s, there were, you know, we did see a few champagne growers, but they were, you know, nobody really knew who they were. They were definitely a hand sell. I mean, I remember, you know, working in California, my sales rep for Salos would come in with a bag with the entire range and, you know, want to take me to dinner so that I could taste these wines. And,
where are,
you know,
they now, right?
On them.
Yeah, where are they now? It's crazy.
Yeah. It's
Burgundy's similar too, you know, it's just available and cheaper, you know.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, back then, you know, we could drink all the Burgundy that we wanted. And it's, you know, and that's certainly changed.
So tell me something about grower champagne. A couple of things. You know, take a few seconds to, you know, describe or define what it is. But the question is, these growers that are now making champagne, and you'll define what and how they do it, they were growing and selling to the large houses? They weren't bottling for themselves?
It depends. So yeah, the distinction that we make, you know, between like growers and houses, basically we think about grower champagne. I mean, things are changing, and we'll talk about that in a second. But you know, when we think about grower champagne, we think about champagne being made by the same people who grew the grapes.
Right.
Which is not always the case. You know, champagne, historically, champagne has been, the structure of the champagne industry has been one that's been very multi-tiered. Right. So you have people who own vineyards and who you know, farm the land and they grow grapes. They might make some wine, they might not. They might sell their grapes to négociants, people who are buying grapes and making wine, and that's always been very lucrative, right? Because your overhead is much less if you're not making wine. You know, you're just farming, and then you grow these grapes, you sell them off, and you know, and that's very good business. So then négociants, houses, they would purchase. They might have vineyards of their own, but then they will also buy grapes from growers and then, you know, blend these together and, you know, make their wines. I mean, this has existed in Champagne, you know, for a very, very long time, for hundreds of years. So there have been certain periods in Champagne's history where economically, you know, this has kind of broken down, like 100 years ago, or 120 years ago now, you know, beginning of the 20th century, you know, there was a time of real economic difficulty where growers were sort of unable to sell their grapes to, like négociants, just they didn't want to buy because you know, the market was down, you know, they had too much wine in their cellars, whatever.
Right.
So some growers started to produce their own wine. Others sort of banded together to create cooperatives, and you know, this is sort of the period where you see the emergence of cooperatives in Champagne, you know, and things like that. You know, later on after the war, after both wars, you know, there was a period certainly after the First War, and then again, you know, in the 40s and 50s after the Second War, you see a lot of growers again starting to make their own wines. Because they had difficulty selling grapes, right?
Right.
So in fact, you know, a lot of these estates that were new to us 20 years ago, right? They had been making wine for a very long time. Like they didn't just start, you know. Some of them had just recently
right.
started, but most of them, you know, had this family tradition for several generations of already producing champagne. It's just that their wines were being sold locally. And, you know, we
right.
in export markets didn't really have access to them.
So people, you know, when you hear that, you know, you think, well, the grower is smaller, you know, maybe he's paying more attention to viticulture. I don't think this would be true, but does size have anything to do with quality? Not necessarily, right?
Yeah, this is something that I always have a problem with. You know, it's like today in sort of whatever popular wine culture, it's, you know, it's become this sort of narrative that that smaller is automatically better. You know, it's
right.
So, you know, we talk about small growers and big houses. You know, and those words are very loaded. They have implications, and I really fight against this all the time. You know, it's I think size has nothing to do with quality. I think that I think it's a little bit dangerous and a little bit misleading, you know, to think about, you know, in these, you know, to think about these terms in that way, you know, like small growers versus big houses. And that's something that I deliberately avoid. Like in La Fête du Champagne, you know, for example, you know, Daniel right. and I, from the very beginning, we have never separated growers and houses. That was very deliberate. I wanted to do that, you know, very deliberately.
Meaning making sure there's representation of everyone.
Well, and not even setting up, it's not even a comparison or contest or, you know, it's
Makers?
Yeah, I'm interested in wines that are interesting and wines that have right. something to say and wines that are of high quality. Yeah. And I really don't care if you're a grower or a house. I don't care if you're RM or NM or if you're, you know, if you're big or
just
small.
Tell everyone RM and NM, well, Negocian so, and, you know, quick definition.
Yeah. So on every bottle of champagne, well, let's say every champagne producer is assigned a status, right? Depending on, it's basically your business structure. So an RM means that you are producing wine, but you're producing wine almost exclusively from your own grapes. There's this 5%, you know, kind of like,
so it's little equal to estate grown in a way.
Yeah, it's basically estate grown. Right. That's what RM is. NM means that you have the ability to purchase grapes.
And some people would think, well, how do you control everything and your wine can't be that good? False, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think you know, slowly in the market, people are kind of losing this attachment to RM. You know, maybe 10 years ago, RM was a really big deal among, like, consumers and wine professionals, you know. It was a little bit misguided and you know, a little bit misleading. You know, people automatically thought that RM was a sign of quality, and it's really not. I mean, even, you know, as early as, like, I mean, even 20 years ago, I remember Pierre Larmandier was very adamant about this. he would always say, grower champagne is not a category.
<That's>
and
fair.
I loved that because, you know, I would be in the vineyards with him. I mean, he is, like, militantly biodynamic, you know, and he's, I mean, he's, you know, just as a winemaker and wine grower, I mean, you know, he's working at the highest levels. But, you know, we would be out in the vines and he would, you know, point to a vineyard next to him and say, you know, look at my neighbor. This guy is, you know, he's an RM. He's a small family run grower, you know, and whatever, you know, the vineyards look like the surface of the moon. You know, it's like pesticides, herbicides, you know, he's like, you know, there's what's so great about that? Like, you know, like, just because you're a grower doesn't mean, you know, doesn't have any implications at all, you know, in terms of quality.
Right. Well, listen, Champagne is a tough place to grow grapes. I mean, the weather isn't great. You know, there's all kinds of mildew, downy mildew. I mean, requires treatments. Some people refrain from, some people treat. You mentioned earlier Champagne, there's always been a focus on the process. Mm-hmm. I think we are seeing a shift to the vineyards. I mean, can you tell us about some of the improvements, you know, in viticulture? I think things are going in the right direction. You know, there's more discussion of viticulture, which alone is a good thing.
I mean, by far. It's you know, certainly viticulture is the number one topic in Champagne today, and I mean, and it's not just the avant-garde. It's not just, you know, the great growers that we know and love. It's the appellation as a whole. It's the region as a whole, and so it's not only the, you know, it's not only the like cutting edge growers. It's actually initiatives coming down from the CIVC, which is sort of the governing body of Champagne, you know, trying to move the region forward. And it's actually been very successful over the last 20 years now. And so, you know, Champagne, it's always had quite a bad reputation as far as viticulture goes, you know, especially by the end of the 20th century. You know, you went to Champagne and the vineyards looked pretty bad.
like the moon, you said.
Yeah, yeah. And so So, I mean, Champagne was by no means the only wine region in Europe that looked that way. I mean,
right.
I mean, even today, like if you travel around Europe, it's you know, it's not like everybody is organic and biodynamic and has these beautiful vineyards. Champagne, I don't even think is necessarily the worst looking place, but that doesn't even matter because, right, it's not about comparison. It's about, you know, what are you actually right. doing? And so it was early in the 2000s that the CIVC, you know, as I said, you know, the governing body of Champagne, they kind of set out these initiatives to, they wanted to move the region forward, but it's hard when you have, you know, 4,000 growers and, you know, 4,000 wine producing growers and, you know, like 200 or 300 négociants, and, you know, everybody has different ideas. Everybody, you know, it's like herding cats, right? So, but they've actually been very successful, you know, they point to all sorts of things, right? Reduction of herbicides, reduction of pesticides. But then also what's really interesting is that they've been working on sort of overall carbon footprint and, you know, other issues of sustainability. So, you know, addressing things like recycling and waste management and water recycling and industrial waste and all of this stuff. And you know, yes,
things is the move buy-in? Slowly. Is the buy-in good? I mean, is the when you look at the percentage of participation,
yeah,
I'm sure it's not where it should be, but I mean, do you see the trend going in the right direction?
I mean, it's definitely slow, and it's, you know, certainly more needs to be done, and you know, and all that. I mean, you can criticize it all you want, but if you look at data, you know, over the last 15 years, you know, they point to things like carbon footprint per bottle. I don't know how they measure this, but, you know, they say there's been a 20% reduction, right? In things like industrial waste, you know, treatment, recycling, you know, there's right. been a 90%, you know, like, or now let's say 90% of this, you know, is being treated and recycled. Phytosanitary products, like when you talk about like fertilizers and right. you know, things, these sort of things that we're putting into the vineyards and the soils, you know, we've seen a 50% reduction in that over the last 15 years. And so, I mean, that's encouraging, but then, you know, they have these goals. You know, they're looking at, actually, we're now in 2022. They're looking at absolutely zero herbicides in the region by 2025, which is not
that
far away.
Wow, that's so close. No, not at all.
And they're actually on track to meet that goal, which is amazing. You know?
And I don't want to get too nerdy, but the treatments that herbicides addressed, they're available and effective. It's just getting people to buy in.
Yeah, it's teaching people, you know, alternative methods. It's making people, you know, aware of what these things are doing to soils and giving right. them incentives. You know, and right. and obviously it's easier with a new generation. You know, there are certainly you know, certainly older growers are more resistant, and then their sons or daughters take over, and the task becomes easier.
Right.
And
because their kids are running around, you know, the vineyards yeah. or the vines.
Yeah. And yeah.
So in a similar vein, I wanted you to discuss climate change, which it's a broad term, but it has an effect on everything we just discussed. Everything I read that Champagne is affected by the changes in climate, you know, it's more prevalent there than other, you know, wine regions. What are the effects? I mean, is it bud break, early harvesting, type of stuff? And is it being addressed properly?
So, you know, Champagne being a marginal wine region, you know, historically Champagne has been really sort of at the northern limits of grape growing. In France. So, you know,
northern regions, limits geographically?
Just in terms of climate.
Okay.
So, you know, especially like prior to the 1970s, or let's say prior to the 1980s, when the climate was very different, you know, Champagne would have like maybe 3 good vintages out of 10. You know, and this is why, you know, the reserve program exists, and this is why,
right?
I mean, this is something Champagne has always struggled with, you know, in forever, and so I think that, you know, when you look at wine regions that are near the edges, you feel the effects of climate change more, right? Just because there's a more drastic difference. So you know, you look at like Germany, you know, like the Mosel, or you know, you look at, you know, and any wine regions that you know sort of like lie at the fringes, and Champagne is certainly one of those. And so you know, looking at the last 30 or 40 years, I mean, there's no question that you know, climate change is real. I mean, if you're still denying it at this point, then I don't know what to tell you. And it's brought. Entirely different conditions, and it really changed growing seasons and changed threats. And so today what we're seeing really is that winters tend to be milder, so there's in general, you know, there's less frost, or during the winter there's less of a freeze, or less of really like a hard freeze.
Does that help, you know, kill mildews and the
absence of that or not really? In fact, it's not good. A milder winter is not good because in the past there are like various organisms, you know, there could be, you know, there could be organisms that would normally be killed by the cold weather, killed by a freeze in the past, that right. nowadays are surviving through the winter. You know? So that's one consideration of, you know. But regardless, winters tend to be milder now. And then what's really pernicious is that we're seeing this burst of warm weather quite early on in the year. So it can sometimes be as early as February. You know, usually it's like March, in the beginning of April. And so it's great for us as humans because, you know, I'm sitting out in my backyard in a t-shirt in March, But in fact, in terms of the vineyards, you know, this is a real problem because that accelerates growth at the beginning of the season, and Champagne is always susceptible to frost all the way up until like June and sometimes even July. So what happens is that we have this period of accelerated growth in the spring, and that won't last. It can't last. And so then when the frosts come, there's more growth to be damaged. So the effects of the frosts are harder.
Like potential bud break and development of the plant and all of that.
Yeah,
stuff.
The buds are farther along. You know, they're more susceptible
because to damage. Because of the early warmer weather.
Exactly.
Due to global climate change, right.
Yeah. And then along, you know, also, climate change brings more extremes. Right? So you have more incidences of sort of catastrophic events. So storms are stormier. You know, like frosts are more virulent. You know, it's so when the frost does come, usually it's worse off. It's worse in so many ways, you know, than it
everything is intensified.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Hard to come out of it. You know, other times you put up whatever, you know, candles, boxes, and you could fight it off, but not in these current conditions, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, our summer, our July is always pretty rainy in Champagne. And then August gets really hot. Again, it's these extremes where you have this really cool July and then you have this heat wave. You have this like enormous spike in August, which is kind of getting normal every year. But the thing is that the summers aren't as cool as they used to be. So in the past in Champagne, you would get, you get either mildew or oidium, so downy mildew or powdery mildew. You would very rarely get both. And today, because of the warmer overall temperatures, we really start to see both every year.
Do they require separate treatment? One thing can ward them off?
It depends on what you do, I suppose. But it does require more treatment. Mildew is always a problem in Champagne. Downy mildew has historically been the most pernicious problem in the Champagne region in terms of viticulture. And so that's something that we have to contend with every year. That certainly isn't changing. But then going back to extremes, now we're seeing August actually be quite a problem. Just
too
yesterday.
Hot?
So,
what does that do to the grape, the acid, the sugars, harvest time?
Well, certainly it accelerates sugar production and acidity falls. So, rapidly, right? So you have this very rapid accumulation of sugar. A lot of people make a big deal about acidity. It's not the main issue in Champagne. Champenois focus on it too much because of this it's still this kind of 70s, 80s mentality that's ingrained in them. But also with this extreme heat, we see sunburn. There are grapes that actually shrivel on the vine. It changes the whole flavor profile of these wines.
Right.
And accelerated growth in that way is not—it's not really desirable. One of the things that makes Champagne what it is this long, cool growing season, and that creates a very particular style of wine. Right? That's what brings you elegance and finesse, and that's also what brings you ripe grapes at a very low level of alcohol. So sometimes in Champagne, people will harvest at 10 or 10.5 degrees of potential alcohol. And in California, you're looking at this and you're saying, well, they're just harvesting green grapes, right?
Right.
But
13, 14, right, yeah.
the thing is that's the key. In Champagne, we're not harvesting green grapes. We're harvesting fully ripe grapes, but they only have like 10.5% alcohol because of this long, cool growing season.
Right.
And so now with these heat spikes, this is upsetting that. Right, to where now you have sugars really accumulating so fast that growers are forced to pick earlier, and that changes flavor profile, certainly. That changes relationship between sugars and acidity. It causes you to completely rethink your whole style of wine, really.
That's a substantial challenge.
Absolutely.
That's unbelievable. Peter, we have to take a quick break.
Yeah.
When we come back, we'll finish up on that. We're talking to Peter Liam. Peter, as I mentioned earlier, is truly one of the great Champagne minds and experts in the country. When we come back, Peter, I want you to talk a little about dosage, chalk, and a few other things that are very much connected to Champagne. You're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back with Peter Liam.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheese making craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Peter Liam. Peter, you were talking about the effects of climate change and, you know, it's a timing thing. And it involves the acids of the grapes, the sugar, when you have to pick, how you have to change and make the wines. I think when you talk about the word sugar, I think you think dosage, and could easily be one of the most misunderstood topics in Champagne.
Yeah, for sure.
To a lot of people, it seems to have a negative perception, especially now with the movement towards natural wines and all that. You know, if it has sugar or dosage, it sucks. So a couple things, because I think you would agree with me that dosage is an important aspect of what champagne is. Explain quickly, you know, what dosage is and try to get a little into the hoopla, you know, that I'm talking about. If you can.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a complicated subject, and it's one that's severely misunderstood, not only by consumers, but also by producers themselves, which is ironic. So, you know, dosage is the addition of sugar right at the end. So champagne ages on its lees, right? and on these dead yeast cells left over from the second fermentation. Champagne, that will go on for several years, you know, whatever, however long. It gets disgorged, so that means that the lees are taken out. And then a little bit of sugar, a little bit of wine is put back in, and in that wine, you know, it's made this solution with a certain quantity of sugar.
Wait, stop for a second. So the lees, is that sediment or what's the word I'm looking for? Byproduct from the grape or whatever.
Well, so it's actually physical dead yeast cells. So it's from you know, the second fermentation is done by putting sugar and yeast into the bottle, stoppering the bottle.
And but then, you said the old lees are through the disgorgement are taken out, right?
Yeah, because
and then the dosage adding sugar is done.
Yeah, so that's
okay.
That's a different process. Yeah, so, right. So in the second fermentation, the yeast consumes the sugar. It creates bubbles essentially, and then the yeast die and the yeast remain in the bottle, you know, through this period of aging.
Is there any effervescence before that? Adding the sugar creates
the effervescence, right, in a bottle.
Okay,
of champagne.
I just want people to realize that.
Yeah. So that's how the effervescence is created, right? And okay. So this aging on the lees, on these dead yeast cells, is a very important part of the champagne process, but those lees need to be taken out before you sell the bottle, right? Because nobody wants to drink that. And so, right. So this process of disgorgement is the process of actually removing those from the bottle. And so then before the final cork is put back in, you know, normally there's a little bit of sugar that's put in the bottle with it. And that is the dosage. And so here's where, you know, all these misunderstandings come up, because we think of it as an additive, right? So we think of it as perhaps an unnecessary additive, because, you know, who wants to put sugar in? I mean, I don't put sugar in my coffee. Like, you know, I try not to put refined sugar in just about anything that I, you know, cook or eat. You know, so why would I want it in my wine? And the problem is that even producers themselves don't actually always know why it is that they're adding dosage. You know, some people say that it's to balance champagne's high acidity. So like the lemonade model, right? So like you squeeze a bunch of lemons into a pitcher, there's this ripping acidity and you have to balance it out by putting some sugar in it, and then it creates something nice to drink, right? You know, some people are saying, well, this is the purpose of dosage. But it's not just that, in fact. It's not just to balance the acidity. In fact, dosage in champagne, you know, in my book, I make the analogy of salt, where we don't always put salt in our food to make it salty. Right? That's not the purpose of salt.
Right.
You know, salt completes a dish. It expands other flavors. It interacts with other flavors, and it completes the dish in a way that is very specific to salt. Right.
Like, I think you use beef as an example, how it enhances it.
Sure. And so even if then, you know, your dish doesn't taste overtly salty, it's completed in a way that it wouldn't have been otherwise. And this is exactly what the addition of sugar does. This is exactly what dosage does in a champagne.
And so why? Go ahead.
Well, and so the thing is that because of this, the specific amount of dosage is different for every wine. Just like the specific amount of salt is different for every dish, right? You can't just salt by numbers, right?
Right.
When you're cooking. And right. by the same token, you can't do that with champagne either. So you know, people make a lot of, because dosage is measured in numbers, right? You know, people make a big deal about, like, oh, 3 grams per liter or 6 grams per liter or 9 grams per liter, and, you know, like, this is too much, this is too little. It's just a number. Like, the number.
I mean, there's like a zero dosage movement, which is silly, right? Because of silly. Everything you said.
Yeah.
You know,
It's like saying I don't eat salt. Like, you know, my food, right. Like my food is so good that it doesn't need salt. And, you know, maybe that's the case, but you know, that seems like a pretty silly statement. And there are, the thing is, you know, there are champagne, because every champagne is different, every champagne finds its balance point at a different level of dosage. It's entirely possible that a champagne might be complete without dosage. So one champagne might need 5 grams, another might need 9 grams, another one might need zero. But actually, I think that the ones that need zero are, they're much less common than you would think by seeing how many non-dosé wines there are, you know, in the marketplace.
Right.
I think that there are a lot of zero dosage champagnes out there that should have some dosage. And you know, and it's not at all that I'm against zero dosage champagnes. I mean, when I hit a good one, I love it. You know, it's
right. Just as a broad thing, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. As a category, like this doesn't make sense to me.
Like, wasn't there a story where Solos added sugar when everyone thought he shouldn't, and it helped the vintage, and it was a more ageable wine, which threw against, you know, common, you know, thought of all of that.
2003 was a really great example of that, where everybody said, oh, 2003, and it was a very hot year. You know, the alcohol levels were high, the, you know, ripeness was very high, flavors were kind of roasted, acidity was low, and everyone was like, oh, you know, like, if, you know, dosage is going to take this wine over the top. Like, you know, everybody wanted to make non-dosé wines, you know, in that vintage. And he was the reverse. He said, no, the way that all of these components interacting in this wine, like, I actually need more dosage than usual in order to make a complete wine. And he was right.
Yeah. And the right guy to, you know, prove that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about another thing, and we can get pretty nerdy on this, and I don't want you to, because I have a thing called the wine list, which you did the last time you were on. I wanted to get your preferences on some wine, so I want to leave a little time with that. Mm. But I think when people think of terroir, and more specifically the soil in Champagne, I think everybody, you know, thinks chalky soils. Mm-hmm. And, my studies show that it's not as simple as that. You know, people think of Champagne as one region. Mm-hmm. You are even controversial to this extent that you think that it's even more regions than the amount of regions they say, which, like I said, is a whole discussion. But is chalk the predominant soil, or is that what makes Champagne, or that's too simplistic?
I mean, you know, short answer is yes. Simplistic answer is yes. Certainly, the majority of Champagne lies on on this Cretaceous chalk. That's certainly the most famous soil type in Champagne. But Champagne is not only about chalk. And so the more you get into like the kind of nitty-gritty details of Champagne terroir, the more you have to pay attention to things other than chalk. I mean, there's right. on a macro level, there's like, you know, the Côte d'Ivoire in the Aube, which is not even on chalk at all. That's on Kimmeridgian. So it's the same. It's exactly the same kind
so
of
Kimmeridgian. So the Aube is a region where chalk is not prominent.
There is no chalk. Yeah.
Okay.
Like literally, it's Kimmeridgian marl, which is an older soil, and it's exactly the same soil that's found in Chablis, but you know, here they grow Pinot Noir and they put bubbles in it. And it's amazing. It's great.
Peter, you have a very trained palate. This is almost a silly question, but I need to know. So you have a quality champagne from the Aube, and then you have another region that's predominantly chalk. Blind right away, you could tell?
Not necessarily
or mostly?
I'm not going to say, you know, that I don't make mistakes because I always do. Every day.
I know that, but generally.
But yes, in general, yeah. I think that the Aube has, you know, the Aube has a very distinct signature that I think is easily learned.
Right.
So it's just a matter of experience.
And then in other regions where chalk is prominent, does it appear in different ways? You know, it's not on the surface, it's underneath.
So a lot of the time, with chalk, it really depends on what lies on top of it and in what quantity. So if you look at the Côte de Blanc, right? The Côte de Blanc is when we talk about chalk and champagne, this is like the purest example. This is where there's very, very little topsoil. Sometimes there's only like 20 or 25 centimeters of topsoil on top, and then it's immediately into this bedrock of chalk. So this is part of the reason why it's famous for Chardonnay, because Chardonnay likes really chalky soils, you know, and right. Pinot Noir really struggles in that. But it's perfect for Chardonnay. But then, you know, Pinot Noir likes to have a little bit more clay in the topsoil. And so when you look at like the great areas of the Montagne de France, maybe you have a little bit more topsoil. You have maybe like, you know, half a meter to a meter. And the function of this topsoil is very important. You know, obviously the chalky bedrock is also important, but because especially, you know, the roots are going, I mean, in a if you, with quality viticulture, the roots are descending and going down into the chalk.
Right.
But that layer above the chalk is, you know, has very important functions as well. As you move farther west in the region, like going into the western Montagne de France and then going into the Vallée de la Marne, the chalk actually descends farther and farther below the surface. And so you reach a point in the Vallée de la Marne, actually, where the chalk is really not significant at all, where you're really talking about other soils. Oftentimes, these soils are calcareous. So they can be various types of limestone. Right. They can be, you know, various marls and sorts of things. But that chalky bedrock is so far below the surface that it's not really, it's not playing a role like it does in the heart of Champagne. Right. So short answer is like chalk. Yes, it is the predominant soil type in Champagne, but it varies.
Yeah. All right. I'm shutting down our conversation on chalk, and we have precious few minutes left. So I want to do a couple things. One of the things I want to do is every week we ask our guests to participate in the wine list. You did this one 4 years ago, so I will compare notes. Everyone gets the same five questions. They've been the same five questions for over 200 interviews. They're fairly simplistic, but our listeners love to hear, you know, what our guests are drinking. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you tasting? Seasonal changes. Give me a few things. Obviously champagne, but what else?
You mean in general in the wine world?
Yeah. I mean, and now, you know, the last weeks, month.
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever I'm here in the States, because in the States, you know, there's such a greater variety of wine than there is in France. So I'm always looking for things that I can't get in France. So like, I always love drinking Italian wine, you know, when I'm here in New York.
You can get good access to it.
Yeah, Northwest Italy, Northeast Italy, Sicily, it's
all the interesting places.
Yeah. You know, I mean, German and Austrian wine, you know, something that's very difficult to find in France. So, you know, I like drinking that here. So I actually drink very little French wine, you know, when I'm in the States.
All right. So those are good ones. Peter, next question. I asked you this the last time we did the wine list. It's kind of the goofiest question on the list, but your favorite wine and food pairing?
I don't remember what I said last time, but
that's good. Neither do I. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't champagne and oysters, but I'm gonna check.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know. I would maybe say like champagne and fried chicken.
That's a good one.
I mean, fried food of any sort, you know, fish and chips, or like anything fried, even just potato chips, like, you know, it's fantastic.
It's perfect with champagne. With that.
But fried chicken of all sorts, like, you know, I mean, you know, it could be Southern fried chicken, it could be karaage, it could be like Korean fried chicken, like it could be whatever. But the interaction of like fried food and champagne is amazing.
I totally agree. All right. This is a very probably easy but very tough question for you to answer. And I don't want you to feel that, you know, it's exclusive. See if you can answer it. Do you have a favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And when you answer it, whatever you answer is not number one or the only one, but just places that you admire. I mean, is there a place or two in New York that comes to mind? Is there a place in Champaign that just when you walk in, you know, it just feels great? They have the selection, the knowledge, you know, the vibe. Does anything come to mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, at home in Champagne, you know, certainly Les Avisés, you know.
What's the name of it?
Les Avisés, which is Solosa's restaurant, on the Jacques Solosa estate. I've been going there since the very beginning, since they opened, and you know, I mean, I'm a bit biased because, you know, I'm friends with them.
I think you're
whatever,
right
but,
on this one.
But that place is amazing. I mean, the food is fantastic. The wine list is amazing. The prices are reasonable. And, you know, I tend to go there a lot. You know, in France, I mean, certainly you have like the grand wine list, like Le Crayer, you know, but Racine, you know, which is one of the best restaurants in France is amazing. You have these wine bars, like Le Wine Bar is one of them, and Glupot is another, where they have, I mean, that's where winemakers go to drink. You know, those two
that's
places.
That's the stuff I'm looking for you. Those are all good. I think you gave me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 places. Say no more. I'll post those. And I'm happy to stay in France. All right. Fourth question. And this question has morphed since I asked it to you. The question was favorite all-time wine. And I think when I started asking the question, I was fishing from guys like you who have access. What's the rarest, most expensive wine, you know, you've ever tasted? I kind of can give a crap about that now.
Yeah.
I think the question is, what's that wine that had a significant impact in your life, you know, that was, you know, a realization, maybe something sentimental. Is there a wine or two that checks that box?
I mean, there's probably a new one like every month, right? But but I'm actually going to say 2013 Louis Roederer Cristal.
Why?
And this wine, so it's just
more about the story than the wine.
Yeah, well, so yes. So you know, this wine was just released a few months ago, and and so the wine itself is amazing. I mean, when I first tasted it, you know, I wrote, this is the best Cristal ever made, which is, you know, totally hyperbolic statement, but I think it's actually true. And the, you know, the story behind it is that Louis Roederer is really at the forefront of viticulture in Champagne. You know, I mean, they are on the bleeding edge. And since, like, so for the past 20 years now, you know, Jean-Baptiste Le Caillon and his team have been working really hard at you know, going back to what we talked about in the beginning about, like, rethinking the paradigm, you know, rethinking, like, how we make champagne, how we grow champagne, what even is champagne. You know, they've been thinking about all of these questions and really trying to address this in a very meaningful way. And so in the vineyards, they're doing things that, you know, seem like they're from the future. And so
for a bigger house too, right?
Well, so what does it even mean, like a big house, you know? Again,
well, we discussed that a little, that they're capable you know,
I mean, volume. Yeah. So, you know, they make 2.5 to 3 million bottles a year, you know, which in terms of negociants, you know, is not large. It's not small. But there's a certain volume and a certain sort of, I guess, it makes certain resources available to you when, you know, you have that kind of money. And so they've been doing amazing things. And in Champagne, time moves very slowly, right? Because you do something and you're maybe not releasing this wine for another like 7 or 8 years or 10 years or whatever. And so you won't really know what the effects are for a while. We don't see, you know, we're only seeing now what people were doing, you know, back in like the 2000s. Mm. And so, you know, over time, like, you know, we've seen Cristal, we've seen these changes in Cristal. You know, 2002 came out, which was amazing. 2004 was similarly amazing in a completely different way. 2008, you know, 2009, I thought was really fantastic. But then, you know, in 2012, it's like it comes out and it's completely different. And people are like, wow, like this is as good as it gets. Like, you know, this wine is amazing. Like, you know, now, you know, we're really seeing like what's happening at Roederer. And then 2013 comes out. And for me, it even surpasses 2012 in this, like, in reflecting Jean-Baptiste's ideas, in reflecting this viticulture, in reflecting like everything that's been going on at the house for, you know, the previous like, you know, 10 to 15 years. And for me, this wine just encapsulates all of his philosophy, you know, in this bottle. And that's really powerful to see.
And so that's 2013.
Yeah.
Fairly recent wine, Cristal. All right. Last question, and the question normally is best wine around $15, $15, $20, $22, a red and a white. I'm going to abandon that question and sort of ask you this. Where, how, what do we do to find the best value in champagne? We know that, like any wine, you know, champagne can be expensive and that the lower ends are, you know, you could find a pretty good $18, $20, you know, Chablis or something or Chardonnay. Hard to do that with champagne. How do we figure the best value?
Yeah. So, you know, value, of course, doesn't always necessarily mean the lowest price, right?
But, you know, quality to value to price. Yeah.
So two things. One, non-vintage champagne, I think, is the best value, is one of the very best values that you can find in the wine world for truly age-worthy wine. Right.
Explain why, because there's aged wine blended in, right?
Yeah, so non-vintage wine is, you know, typically a blend of various vintages, and so we think that, well, it's because it's designed to be more ready to drink upon release, then you should drink it now and you shouldn't, you know, and it's like, there's no point in aging it. And in fact, it's totally untrue. Like this, like any other wine, it's going to develop with time. And in some cases, it might develop a lot longer than you expect. I mean, I've tasted non-vintage wines that have been 20, 30, 40 years old, which, you know, have been amazing. And so, you know, these are typically the lowest priced wines in a producer's portfolio. And yet, you know, even if you're just putting it away for a year or two, you know, this is like, I mean, this offers, you know, tremendous value in age-worthy wine. But then I often think, though, that like the real value in a producer's portfolio is the regular vintage. It's because, so, you know, a lot of times the standard portfolio of a producer will have, there'll be the non-vintage wine, you know, which is the lowest priced wine. There'll be like the prestige cuvée, which is the highest priced wine and the most special, you know. And so people always want those. So the prestige cuvée tends to be priced quite high, the non-vintage quite low. And it's that one, it's that middle child, the regular vintage, which always gets kind of lost in the shuffle. And you can often find those at really good prices. Right. And so I think, you know, speaking of, you know, taking a wine, putting in your cellar and, you know, something that you can put away for 10, 15 years. I mean, those are oftentimes, you know, really great places to look.
That's a great way to look at, you know, to get the best quality and value. I didn't mention, but I post all the answers on our social media. Mm-hmm. So our listeners, you know, can have access to them. Peter, I have to wrap up. Like I said, offline, we probably could have discussed any one topic for over an hour, but I'm happy with everything we discussed and all your insights. Let me do a quick wrap up, and I want to get some info from you. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. I can't make a better case for subscribing. When a guy like Peter Liam comes on, you want to know that by subscribing, it automatically pops up and it's ready for you to listen. So please subscribe. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby, and on Twitter, we're at BenRuby. But you can use the hashtag TheGrapeNation on both to get to us. As I mentioned, we'll post Peter's wine list on our social media sites. Peter, you do a lot of stuff, so try to answer this question with the right info. Where can we find you and all your work on social media and online? Let's start with the book Champagne. You can get that wherever books are sold. Support your local bookseller, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So my Champagne book is still out there.
Quick question on that. Any thought of a revision, or are you working on any other book?
Not at the moment. Not anytime soon.
Okay. It's a seminal book, so it's very timely. All right. Your website?
So my website is champagneguide.net. And social media wise, I'm most active on Instagram, where my handle is just Peter Lieb.
Okay.
But I'm on Twitter as well.
All right. And Peter, one day I'm going to do a podcast on deep sea and cave diving, and we will be able to talk about that a little more in depth. I'm sorry we didn't get to that a little. I want to thank our guest, Peter Liam. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Sam.
Kind of kick the new year off with champagne, and I appreciate that. Thanks to our engineer, Matt, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benrubi, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.